Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the next episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. You know, since I'm just beginning to post the video versions on YouTube, I wanted to take a minute to tell our newer viewers and listeners about Game of Crimes. This is the place to hear some of the best true crime content anywhere. I have a guest on each episode so you can hear firsthand, real-life, true stories of heroes in action. I'm talking about our law enforcement professionals, our military, and our first responders. This is where you'll hear about their dedication to duty, commitment to excellence, bravery in the face of danger, and the sacrifices they make to protect all of us. Most of these guests aren't looking for recognition or personal glory. They go out and they do a job that they love, a job which at any time could cost them their lives. They do this for people they don't even know and many times will never know. And as an added bonus, you'll occasionally hear a former bad guy on the show. Now, I know that sounds a little weird, but it gives us a look from the criminal's perspective. You might not hear that anywhere else. So whether you're a new listener or viewer or a regular here on Game of Crimes, none of this would be possible without your support. I can't thank you guys enough for checking out the show, for coming back week after week. You know, just saying thank you doesn't seem adequate. And that's one of the reasons I'm always trying to add something new to Game of Crime. It's my small way of showing my gratitude to you. So thank you. Now, last week, I announced a couple of changes to the show, and I'm curious to find out if you've had a chance to check them out yet. Today's episode is number 153, but starting with last week's episode, I began posting the video version of our weekly interviews on YouTube, which you can find by typing Game of Crimes Podcast in the YouTube search bar. Now, you'll be able to see the guest, along with yours truly. I'm really not sure why you might want to see us, but there we are. And while you're checking out the new videos, I'd appreciate your support by clicking on that subscribe button. It's just below the video. It doesn't cost you anything but a few seconds, and it really helps out the ratings on the Game of Crime show. By the way, the audio-only versions are still being posted on YouTube as well, so you have the option to listen to the episode or watch it. Is that a little bit confusing? Eh, maybe. But I'm thinking if I can figure it out, I'm pretty sure you guys can figure it out as well. Oh, yeah, and let me know what you think about the opening music video. Last week, I also mentioned bringing a section back to the intro, and I'm happy to let you know that beginning with this episode, Small Town Police Blotter is back. Thanks to our resident Mafia Queen, Sandy Salvato, for her efforts in polling the members of the Game of Crimes fan page on Facebook. You guys voted, and I listened. Now, if you're new to Game of Crimes and wondering what I'm talking about, stay tuned. Small Town Police Blotter will be on in just a few minutes. And one more update from last week, and this is for our Patreon subscribers at the Guardian of the Realm and Warden of the Throne levels only. That's our two highest levels. Beginning with this episode, I've begun posting the raw, uncut, semi-edited version of our weekly guest interviews on Patreon at least 4 days before they're released anywhere else. Now, I know I originally said 1 week, but thinking about it, I really didn't want this early release interfering with our current week's episodes. And remember, these will be commercial-free. They'll rarely have the music, the intro, or the debrief added. The full edited audio and video versions will be posted on Mondays and Tuesdays like we always do, and they'll have the ads included. Those ad sponsors, now they go a long way in keeping Game of Crimes up and running. So show them some love and support them also. If you're not a Patreon subscriber, you can go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and sign up. There you'll find much more content in addition to what you already enjoy in our regular weekly podcast releases. Okay, now we've got to get the housekeeping out of the way. I'd appreciate you going to Apple or Spotify and hitting those 5 stars. If you could do that every week, it really pays off. It only takes a minute, and this way, this small act will actually help support the show. And on YouTube, I'm asking you to click on the subscribe button. trying to grow the subscribers. Send me your comments and feedback on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or to our email address, which is gameofcrimespodcast@gmail.com. My website is gameofcrimespodcast.com. Here you'll find all of our episodes, our book list, some merchandise, and there's a link for Patreon. Again, that's gameofcrimespodcast.com. On Facebook and Instagram, go to Game of Crimes Podcast, and on X, type in Game of Crimes. Also on Facebook, you heard me just mention the Game of Crimes fan page. Go to Game of Crimes Fans. There you can join the best private group on the Facebook platform. That group is run by our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, who I just mentioned a minute ago. She's the queen that rules with an iron fist, but she wears a velvet glove. You'll find a lot of posts and comments, and it's a place to go have a little fun. Now, a quick disclaimer. This is a show about crime. We talk about bad people doing bad things. We talk about bad people doing bad things to good people. Now, I do take these stories very seriously, but it never hurts to have a little laugh. And what's wrong with having a little chuckle about some of the crazy things criminals do? Having said that, it's now time for our return to Small Town Police Blotter. All right, enough of that. Let's get over to our small town police blotter. So we're going to start out here in Rhode Island. A Rhode Island man was arrested 4 separate times in 30 hours for drunk driving. An unmatched criminal feat he accomplished while behind the wheel of 4 different cars. John Lorenco, and just so you know, he's 53 years old. We usually don't identify bad guys here or criminals on the show, but these kind of people deserve to be recognized. So he was first arrested in Providence, Rhode Island, Sunday afternoon when he crashed his Dodge pickup truck into an SUV carrying 2 children. Now, that's not funny. Both of the kids were treated at the Providence Hospital and released, thank God. Well, Lorenco, remember, that's a Sunday afternoon. His next 3 busts occurred in Cumberland, which is a town just outside of Providence, and that's where he resides. At 7:15 Monday morning, Lorenco, this time driving a Chevrolet Malibu, rear-ended another vehicle. Lorenco was subsequently arrested after his blood alcohol content was measured at 0.22, nearly 3 times the legal limit. Ooh, that must have been a hell of a weekend. He was later given a court summons and released to the custody of his 79-year-old father. Now, around 11:15 a.m. that same day, a Cumberland cop spotted Lorenco now behind the wheel of a 1970 Plymouth Barracuda, nice car, driving erratically. Lorenco, who's a general contractor, was pulled over and the officer determined he was intoxicated. He was transported to the Landmark Medical Center, where he was released from police custody to the hospital. That's not enough. Lorenco's 4th arrest that same day occurred around 5 p.m. after he departed the hospital and got into a dump truck. He eventually crashed the construction vehicle into a tree and a wall, doing some heavy damage. Lorenco sustained minor injuries and was transported back to the hospital for treatment of new injuries. Wow. He's getting to be a regular there. Now, this is unbelievable. Lorenco was released on bail following each of the 4 arrests. Really? Could that be right? Well, a judge or a magistrate up there let the guy post bail after his 4th DUI arrest within a 30-hour time frame. You know, when I was a uniformed police officer, and I know that was a long time ago, after your 3rd felony arrest, or after your 3rd DUI arrest, it became a felony, which means you could go to prison. Holy cow. Now, I know this genius, he's not been convicted. We're just talking about his arrest, so he gets his day in court. But what about public safety here? I certainly think that 3 DUI arrests, all which involved accidents, well, actually 4 DUI arrests, 3 involved accidents, I think that might qualify as a risk to public safety. Okay. Wow. You know, and we wonder why crime seems to get worse every day, don't we? Well, let's move on to our next story. And this time we're going to Montana. A Montana woman called 911 to report that she had purchased some bad meth, adding that the drug left a bad taste in her mouth. A Great Falls Police Department officer was dispatched to the home of Marjorie Ann Dayrider. She's 33 years old. And she had dialed the cops to report having a bad reaction to meth that she injected. Why would you call the cops on that? Why wouldn't you call a medical professional? Are you diming yourself out, or are you just that unintelligent? The writer told the officer that she believed she had got some bad meth and was having a bad reaction to it by vomiting, tingling tongue, and a bad taste in her mouth. She continued, "I do meth 3 times a day, every day, and have never had this reaction before." Day Rider said that she and her boyfriend had purchased the drug the night before and that she injected herself at 9 a.m., 11 a.m., and 3 p.m. Does that sound like a problem? While speaking with the patrolman, he kind of loved it. Day Rider said that she still had some meth inside her bra. She then provided the remaining narcotics to the officers, who reported that a field test of the crystalline substance was positive for methamphetamine. Duh. Day Rider was subsequently arrested on a felony narcotics possession charge, carries a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison, and surprisingly, there were additional warrants already on file for the lady. All right, what's our number one rule here on Game of Crimes, kids? Don't do meth. This is what it leads to. All right, well, I hope you enjoyed that. Let's get on with the show. For today's episode, my guest is none other than Billy Queen, a 30-year veteran of law enforcement. He's a U.S. Army vet, a combat veteran, having served 4 years, part of which was spent in Vietnam. And as you're going to hear today, for Billy's final 20 years, he was a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, more commonly known as ATF. Billy became one of the most successful undercover agents anywhere. He infiltrated white supremacist groups, outlaw motorcycle gangs, and he's the only law enforcement professional to ever become a fully patched member of the Mongols outlaw motorcycle gang, one of the most dangerous motorcycle gangs anywhere in the world. You know, I don't know what it is about some of these ATF guys. You've heard other guys on here explain their undercover experiences. They're working undercover against crazies who live by their own set of values and rules, who think nothing of beating, maiming, even killing anyone who might just simply look at them the wrong way. Yeah, I think I was involved in some crazy operations during my time, but these guys, including Billy, they took craziness to a whole different level. You're also going to hear how these types of assignments take a toll on the people living in this undercover world. You know, it tends to blur the lines between good and evil. And make no mistake about it, everybody, these outlaw motorcycle gangs are pure evil. One small caveat here. During Billy's interview, we experienced some Wi-Fi connection issues. So when I was editing, I found a couple of sections where the equipment only recorded Billy or me, not both of us at the same time. I think you'll still enjoy Billy's adventures, but just wanted to give you a heads up in case you see or hear anything that looks just a little strange, okay? So now, are you ready to meet another true American patriot and hero, someone who risked their life for all of us? Well, if so, get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. Here we go with the biggest, baddest, the most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. I'm so excited today. You know, we've had some real studs on this show, and today's no exception. It's a guy that I've heard about for years and years. I finally got to meet him at the Southern California Gang Conference this year and was introduced to him by our favorite guys from the conference, Mel and Santee. Those guys have done so much for our podcast here. So, guys, big shout-out to you. Thank you for continuing to include me in what you do there in the conference and for all the introductions you make for me. You know, we've had quite a few undercover ATF agents here. And for some reason, I think they find people that's got a screw loose, to be quite honest with you, because these stories are just unfrickin' believable. And if you think back, we had Lou Velozzi here in episode 4, one of the very first episodes, almost 3 years ago. He ran the ATF's undercover storefront operations. He now has his own TV show talking about this stuff. We had Dominic Polifrone on, who infiltrated parts of the mafia up in New York City in episode 12. And he's a hoot. Yeah, I mean, it's if we weren't an explicit podcast beforehand, we were after we had Dominic on, because about every third word was the F-bomb. In episode 32, we had Mr. Jay Dobbins, who has become infamous himself, but for the right reasons. I believe he infiltrated, was it the Hells Angels, right, Billy?
Hells Angels, yeah.
And then we brought on Chris Bayless, the Chrisser, episode 42. And I mean, I love all these guys. Bayless is just did the HAs up in Chicago, the Hells Angels, sorry. Got to meet him in person earlier this year at the third annual Military Appreciation Weekend up in Beaufort, South Carolina, put on by Corps Medical Group. What a gentleman. I love that guy. I can call him, even if I do an appearance on TV, he either calls or texts me. I mean, just what a brother through and through. And then we also had Ken Croke on here on episode 94, who infiltrated the Pagans. So, you know, I thought there can't be anybody else, but I'd always heard about this guy named Billy Queen. And Billy is a Southern boy like I am. So, you know, we got that thing going. Our family trees are probably that straight line with no limbs that come off of it. We're probably related down the road somewhere. But after saying all this, I'm honored to introduce you folks to William Billy Queen, retired ATF undercover agent. Billy, welcome so much to Game of Crimes. Thank you, man.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me. All those people that you just mentioned are all friends of mine. I admire them. I learned from them. They learned from me. And they all operated behind the enemy lines and did a great job. And there's others with ATF, too, that have done that. But those guys that you mentioned, they're all my brothers. I respect them. I'm honored to call them my friends, my colleagues. And we all chewed some of the same dirt around the United States.
I tell you what, man, I can just see a psychiatrist getting you guys in a room thinking, oh, you know, I got to figure out what the hell's wrong with these guys that they would do this, because I think you're all crazy, to be quite honest with you.
Well, you know, ATF thought we were crazy, too. I mean, they sent us to the psych people after we got through with operations to make sure our heads were still screwed on straight.
Oh, well, and they found out you had a screw loose before then, right?
Yeah, but yeah, exactly. Why would you do it?
I tell you what, I love you.
And that was an interesting thing, too, because I went through that psych program after my long undercover operation with the Mongols. And they mean well, and the doctors mean well. But what helped me more than anything was a guy named Steve Martin. Steve had ridden, and I hope I get this right, in Florida with the warlords down there. And he did an outstanding job. He actually came to see me once when I had been undercover with the Mongols for more than a year. He stopped in because I know ATF sent him to make sure that my head was still screwed on straight.
Yeah.
And it did me more good to be able to sit down with somebody like Steve Martin, who had been there and done that, rather than talk to a psychiatrist somewhere. And Steve also checked in after I was hiding out, because I had to hide out for years after that operation was over with. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that really helped me was Steve Martin. He came to see me again. Wow. And we spent a couple, 3 days together. He knew what I was going to say before I said it, because he had been there and done that.
Yep.
And I hope ATF or other agencies that might be sending people deep undercover hear what I'm saying.
My old DEA partner, Javier Pena, and I, we have this speaking business that's been going on for 9 years now, talking about the Escobar story in Colombia and all that Medellin cartel. Mm-hmm. And we actually got to speak to the ATF Advanced Undercover Conference in Savannah, Georgia, back before COVID. I remember meeting Carlo there, the agent that was injured in New Orleans here last year. I was actually doing some filming for a TV show down in Miami last year, and got the opportunity to go by the house and see Carlo again. Just sat down and visit with the brother for a while. Just, you know, still in my thoughts and prayers. He's got a lifelong of recovery ahead of him, but
yeah,
just the studs that I met there, and everybody accepted us as part of the brotherhood just simply because we were law enforcement. You know, it's that thin blue line thing. And our listeners hear me talk about that all the time, but it's just amazing that anybody would do this. And you can see hopefully this is going to come out on video. If everything goes right, you can see I've got my Southern California Gang Conference shirt on.
I love it. I love those guys out there in San Diego. They're all my brothers. They do a great job.
Yeah. And this year, so our listeners know, they brought Billy back out. He's presented before out there. I think this is my fifth or sixth year going out, and I just support him. I mean, I'll do the presentation when they ask me to. But this year they brought Billy out and they presented him with the Legacy Award. And we're talking about a conference of roughly 1,000 Southern California police officers. And to be recognized like that and honored, congratulations, brother.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. Thank you for saying that. And I mean, that award has gone to people like Kiki Camarino, and I hope that you'll mention Kiki Camarino more. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he gave up his life for this country in the most horrible way. Yeah. And he's a hero of mine. Joe Pistone, the guy that infiltrated the mob and spent year after year after year up there in New York and running around the United States, knowing every day if they find out who he is, they'll kill him in the most terrible way you could imagine.
Oh, yeah.
I admire Joe, Kiki, so many other guys that have put their lives on the line. It's undercover work is a dangerous thing to get into. You truly are working behind enemy lines. And in so many cases, with so many people being killed, you truly are pretty much by yourself out there. Even if you got a backup team in a room next door to you, if it goes bad, it's you and the bad guys. That's it.
That's exactly right. I haven't met a police officer yet that can outrun a bullet. If they pull that trigger on you, help can't get there quick enough.
I lost so many friends over the years, so many friends in undercover operations. It's just a dangerous way to try to live.
It is. And that's why I'm so excited to have you on the show, man, because I've heard about you for years. And you know, I like to bust your balls about being maybe having a screw loose. I think we all do. But it is a true honor to have you here on the show. Got to hang out with you in San Diego. And that's the cool thing about cops, man. We meet each other, and it's like we've known each other our whole lives.
That's true. And it was great meeting you out there. I was looking forward to doing this. It feels like being there with your cop brothers.
Yeah.
Now, I feel like I'm talking to them now. Mm-hmm. And I know them. They know me. And this is an honor. It's an honor to be able to be here and let people know out there what these people do.
Well,
look, it's not just undercover people. You know, you were out there at Southern California Gang Conference. Those guys are putting their lives on the line every day. There's things that are going on in the country right now that people don't know about. That people wouldn't even think about fishing wildlife out there, having to scrounge through the bushes and through the forest, fighting these infiltrators from outside the country, setting up their illicit activities throughout the United States. I mean, I saw those guys that looked to me like they were Delta Force out there. And this was fishing wildlife. This is what we're coming to in the United States of America out here, fighting the Chinese, fighting the Latinos coming in here illegally. I don't know what else to say about that. I mean, that's it. That wasn't going on when I was in. You know, we were fighting straight up gangsters. Now, these are infiltrators from outside the United States coming in, setting up their enterprises here.
Yep.
That was news to me. It was alarming to me. I want the people out here to know it. I want our legislature to know it. You know, Steve, who does know that? I mean, you're out there. You listen to the stories, the violence that they're bringing into the country. If you're not going to one of these conferences, you don't know it unless you get dropped in your tracks by one of these infiltrators. You just don't know.
And the people
of the United States need to know. It's not just these guys are crossing the border illegally. These guys are crossing the border illegally and setting up their illicit industries in the United States here. And the cops are out here doing the best they can do to fight it. Right. And everybody from the guys on the street in those uniforms to fishing wildlife out there slipping through the bushes and the underbrush to try to bring these organizations down. It's changed, Steve, since you and I were out there on the street.
Mm-hmm.
It's changed. And thank God.
Well, thank God we got heroes that are willing to go out and fight that. And I keep smiling because I know you're talking about John Norris, who I think you met out there at the conference. He spoke this year. And we've had him on the show here. He had his own interview, and then I did an update at the Southern California Gang Conference this year with him and a few other guys that had been on the show previously. And here's one thing I will point out to begin with here is I've created this little saying, and it's corny as hell, but the saying is, just because we retired does not mean that our oath ever expired. And John is living up to that. You're continuing to live up to it. I'm trying to do my best to live up to it here with the show and the presentations and so forth. So it's when young people call us and ask for advice, the first thing I tell them is don't look at this as a 9-to-5 job. This is a lifestyle. It will affect everything in your life if you do the job correctly. But it's a calling also.
That's so true. I would like everybody to understand, when I was doing an undercover operation with the Mongols, we're talking about 9-to-5. Well, in reality, that's 24/7. Oh, that's 24/7, day after day, week after week, month after month. You're doing it, and you're doing it for the love of your country, for your patriotism, because you are not getting paid for it. You get paid up to a certain point, and then you're working for free out there. And people don't know that either.
Yep, that's the honest God truth. So let's get rolling here. Just tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, your family dynamics, brothers, sisters, things like that.
Well, to go back, my dad, he was in the Navy in World War II. He was a UDT, Team 6, in World War II.
Wow.
And I didn't talk to him much about that. I just looked at the pictures, and he became a police officer in Washington, D.C., and then he became an ATF agent, which way back then was ATU. People called them revenuers. They chased Snuffy Smith through the hills out here on the East Coast. And I watched it as a little kid. Mm-hmm. And I kind of thought everybody's dad does that, you know, because he came home and, you know, he would carry machine guns. He had dynamite in the trunk of his car to blow steels up with. And I just thought that's what people do.
That's old school.
Yeah, that's right. And I kind of followed in his footsteps. And it wasn't like it was a picture drawn out. This is what I'm going to do with my life. It's just something inside that led me that way.
Mm-hmm.
When I graduated from high school, I mean, Vietnam was going on hot and heavy. And me and my twin brother, it was written in our minds. When we graduated from high school, we were going to go in the Army and we were going to fight for this country. And we did. After that, when I came home, I was going to be a police officer. And sooner or later, I was going to be an ATF agent. So I joined the High Point Police Department in North Carolina, and I enrolled in college, got a degree in criminal justice, ultimately ended up with the United States Border Patrol. They sent me to California. So that was an eye-opener for a kid that grew up in the hills of North Carolina, kind of gone, put in California, in San Ysidro District, actually worked in Temecula, and chased illegal aliens. And that's what we called them back then. I don't care what they say today. We chased illegal aliens. But I'll tell you something else, too. When I caught an illegal, if I caught him at 4 o'clock, by 6 o'clock, he's going to be back in Mexico.
Yeah.
We filled out voluntary return forms to Mexico. We got their names, whatever it was they told us. We knew they were lying to us, but we didn't care. So we put them on a bus, and we let the door out in Tijuana, Mexico. And that's the way it was with the Border Patrol. And I learned some things even with the Border Patrol. Blair's daddy ended up in a chase with my dad. Bill Blair's daddy had a spotlight he put on the back of his car, and he would hit that spotlight at a certain point in a road where it would be in a turn.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd turn that spotlight off, and my dad said he couldn't see anything but a white dot in front of him. And he drove that 64 Ford off the road and into the woods. And Bill Blair, daddy, ended up doing that. And I ended up working for Bill Blair's son.
Well, that's exactly right. Richard Petty and those boys, I mean, they were all bootleggers down there, but to start, well, they were drivers for the bootleggers. But then that develops into NASCAR. And I was stationed in Greensboro, North Carolina, after coming back from South America. And, you know, you went around, did a lot of work down in Salisbury and Kannapolis, Concord area, Davis and County, Lexington, all those areas down south of Greensboro. And when we were out doing a lot of surveillances, just checking things out, they'd show me where these NASCAR drivers lived. I remember one time Petty was done racing, but he's on his way from wherever to Raleigh, and he's on 85, and he's drafting cars on 85, bumping them in the rear end.
Yeah, he did do that. He got himself in trouble.
Yeah, he did. It was all over the news back then. But old redneck boys, I tell you what, man, it was a different time back then.
You know, Petty probably would have been a significant individual in the political arena out here had he not been bumping cars out on the road. Yeah.
Some habits die hard, right?
I guess so. I like Richard. I spoke with him many, many times and talked to him about my dad. And, you know, Richard Lee Petty used to work on my dad's government cars, try to keep them as fast as the bootleggers. But I didn't know that. Richard Daddy was one of the biggest bootleggers down in Randolph County at the time. I didn't know that. didn't learn that till later on.
Yep. So you come out of high school, you go in the Army. How many years did you do in the Army?
Well, I ended up doing 4 years now. I did almost three, but I joined Special Forces when I got back and ended up spending more time with that.
Okay, so you're going into Special Forces, right?
Yeah, I was operation in an intel the sergeant with an A-team with Special Forces with 11th C Company, 3rd Battalion, 11th Special Forces. And so to get past that, I was with the Border Patrol, and that was just a stepping stone to ATF because of my dad. And once again, they called ATF agents back then revenuers.
Man. Yeah.
And the story with the NASCAR racers. And you hear all kinds of stories about the NASCAR racers, but you don't hear many stories about the guys that actually chased them.
Yeah, that's right.
And I grew up and talking about Bill Blair's dad putting my dad into the woods with that spotlight on the back of his car. That was only one incident. My dad had come home from falling into traps that the bootleggers would set up, and they would dig pits, and they would put barbed wire in the pit, in the bottom of the pits. Oh. They knew where to run. Mm-hmm. The revenuers didn't know. My dad fell in one of them pits full of barbed wire. One night, and I remember my mama putting salve on him with two stitches here, one stitch there, two stitches here, three, all over him.
Oh, my gosh. Now, that just ups the game when you do that.
That does. Yeah. That does. But, you know, that didn't happen that much, but it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it did happen. Bill Blair pulling that light thing.
that's pretty ingenious.
Yeah. And Bill Blair Jr., he talks about that story today.
Yeah.
And we didn't figure it out till just here recently, a few years, that it was my dad that he put into the woods.
How about that?
And, yeah. Yeah. So he tells that story now.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Tired of losing weight only to gain it all back? The weight loss experts at SlimRank.com have done the research. SlimRank.com ranks the safest, most effective GLP-1 programs that get and keep the weight off for good. Stop watching the scale go up and down. Go to SlimRank.com and pick America's number one weight loss program today. SlimRank.com. That's SlimRank.com. Your dream body is just a few months away. SlimRank.com.
So you come out of the military and you go to college next, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I went to college concentrated in criminal justice. And I went to a graduate program in psychology and guidance. But I left that and went to the U.S. Border Patrol because it opened up, and I wanted to get into the federal government as a gun toter, and that was the only thing that was open at the time. So I joined the Border Patrol, and I'm glad that I did, because I got to see the things that I saw with the Border Patrol, learn how to speak Spanish, like as I said, and it was just kind of a waiting game. And it was about a year and a half later that ATF came open, but it came open in Los Angeles, and it was a take it or leave it proposition. So I took it.
Yeah.
So once again, you got this little country boy out of North Carolina now working in Los Angeles, California.
Yeah. But before Border Patrol or ATF, you were a local police officer, correct?
That's right.
That was
8 years with the High Point Police Department. Became the youngest sergeant they ever had at that time with the High Point Police Department.
Work patrol, or did you work in any specialized units?
No, I worked patrol. I became a sergeant in patrol, but some of the most entertaining, fun times I ever had in law enforcement was as a street cop in High Point, North Carolina.
Yeah.
Because you answered everything, you know, everything from murder calls to barking dog calls. Mm-hmm. And you never knew, as you very well know, you never knew what you're going to be walking into. And I walked into everything. But we had a great time. Law enforcement was respected back then.
Yeah.
You know, there were certain people that you were going to have to fight, and they enjoyed it. The cops enjoyed it. That's the way that I can put it. When I got out of Vietnam, I thought nothing was going to, if I can make it through that, nothing was going to be able to kill me. So nothing scared me. And, I had a good time. It made a lot of friends and, duked it out over and over, but to me it was just entertaining.
Yeah.
And this is the way things were. Let me say this about the difference today and the difference back then. If you had a warrant for somebody and you went to arrest them for that warrant and they decided they were going to fight you, well, you'd fight them. You'd fight them, do what you have to do, get them under arrest, take them in. Well, you didn't write up reports on resisting arrest. As long as you didn't have to take them to the emergency room, it was over. They went to jail for the original warrant that they had. You didn't charge them for resisting arrest, assault on a police officer. That's just the way that it was. You didn't have to do that much. But people in the bad areas of town knew you.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew no matter what, you were going to have to fight some of them. But the rest of them, they respected you.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have the problems like you have today.
Yeah, exactly.
And like I said, this is ridiculous. If the guy wants to fight, you know, fight the guy, put the cuffs on him, take him to jail, and end it. But, oh, Lord, got to have a camera because they're going to sue you. They're going to sue your agency if you talk ugly to them.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah, I couldn't do it today. I couldn't do it today. Hey, I'll be locked up myself.
I agree with you 100% on that. And what I think work in uniform does, first of all, I call work in uniform is what I call the real police, because it can be proactive, but it's also reactive because you're answering calls. But that's where you're getting into things. You don't know what you're getting into until you get there. Whereas as you become Border Patrol or ATF or DEA or FBI or Marshals, whatever, you kind of control the circumstances that you get into, and it's very specialized. So, you know, hats off to the uniform guys, especially nowadays.
Sure.
But what it also does is it teaches you how to deal with people.
You know? It sure does. Yes, I mean, it does.
It's a real learning lesson there, and it prepares you for the other jobs that you're going to move on to. So,
you have an understanding. You're exactly right. When you're standing face to face, and we have a tendency to say the bad guys, but they're not. You know, there are people out there that are dealing with crises at the time. There are people out there you got to deal with that get drunk. And for the most part, that's the way that it was when I was a street cop.
Mm-hmm.
The drugs weren't that prevalent on the streets back then. They were starting to pick up.
Mm-hmm.
But you know how people's personalities change once they get intoxicated from one substance to another. Personalities change. They do things that they wouldn't do if they were sober. And you understood that, mm-hmm. that a lot of the times you were dealing with people that really wasn't their character, their personality. They were under the influence. You knew that. You took the appropriate actions. You didn't take it personal. You know, if you had to thump them, you thumped them.
Yeah.
But they understood it too.
Yeah. That liquid courage gets a lot of people in trouble.
Yeah, it does. Makes them get taller and stronger.
At least up here.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny. So now you go into Border Patrol. Did you have to go to the Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy?
I sure did.
That's in Brunswick, Georgia, right?
At Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. That's where it was when I went through. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was one of the toughest schools I had ever been through.
I've always heard that Border Patrol is the toughest in federal law enforcement.
It's a tough school to get through. Yeah, it is. It's a...
That part of Georgia has the meanest mosquitoes and little bugs, little no-see-ums of anywhere in the United States, no-see-ums. I think, also.
Yeah. The military, I'm not sure if there was much difference between the military and the Border Patrol. The military just loved to make you stand out there and have little bugs just eat you up while you're standing at attention. It was funny to them. Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't that much different in the Border Patrol. You had to stand out there at attention just like you do in the military, and they were biting you. You know how it was down at Glencoe, Georgia. It bite the crap out of you. And it's hot and sandy down there. And a lot of the Border Patrol is physical.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it right. The obstacles that they put in front of you that you had to negotiate, deal with, were all relevant to the job. You know, jumping up in the back of a train car. Or jumping over things or climbing under stuff, you're going to end up doing that as a Border Patrol agent.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that the illegals like to do is run from you. So better be in good shape.
You got to be in
good shape. Yeah. Back then I was.
And that's where you learned to speak Spanish, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, what would have happened if you hadn't learned Spanish? They'd boot you out.
You wouldn't be a Border Patrol. Yeah, they'd boot you out. I forgot what the attrition rate was. Really high in Border Patrol school. They put a lot of people out, lots of people out.
Yeah, it's I think it's different. And I'm trying to get Rocco Vasquez on here. I was interviewed on his podcast here a week or two ago, and he's agreed to come on, but he was Border Patrol for his entire career, ended up in BORTAC and all that. But the stories that I've heard him tell were just, and I've read his book. It's amazing. But so is your books. And I've only read one of your two books. But we'll talk about that at the end here. Mm-hmm. So you go out to Temecula and you start to talk about where you learned your tracking skills. When you go out looking for these illegals, how many people were with you?
No more than one more.
And usually by yourself?
Sometimes you're by yourself. Sometimes you're with another guy. But unless you're pulling a raid on some like Del Monte Farms. Mm-hmm. Or some horse farm somewhere, you're going to be by yourself or you're going to have one other person with you. And that's it. And you might take a group down 20, 30, and only be two of you out in the middle of, and if you're on foot tracking them, you're in the middle of nowhere. And if you catch them, you know, if they wanted to, they could easily overwhelm you.
Yeah.
Fortunately, they just wanted to get away. For the most part, did run into some incidences where they wanted to fight you and they would hurt you.
Typically, if you got into a scrape, how close is your backup? That's a good answer.
You better take that into consideration when you get into that scrape.
I was thinking the same thing because we've had, you know, when we get to recording here, names escape me. And I'm looking at my list over here, and I can't find the name, but we had a guy on here that was Border Patrol, and he was out laying up in the rocks hours at a time and having snakes crawl over him and scorpions and other kinds of critters running around out there. And I'm thinking, you're – holy cow, what's wrong with you, man?
Well, you know what? Now I wasn't used to tarantulas. They have tarantulas in California. There are no tarantulas in North Carolina.
Holy cow.
And I was with a Border Patrol agent one day, and we're in the back of woods, just amazing. We could get through it. And he stops the car or Jeep, whatever it was within, and there's a big old tarantula crawling across the road. Well, he jumps out, and he runs up to this tarantula. He puts his hand down in front of the tarantula. The tarantula just crawls up on it in the palm of his hand, and it's about as big as the palm of his hand, this great big spider. And I'm not that afraid. I've never really been afraid of – I'm more afraid of a poisonous snake than I am a spider. But he's putting his hand in front of the other hand, and this big old spider is just crawling. And he said, he's like, hold your hand out. So I did, and this big old tarantula crawls into my hand, and I do the same thing that he's doing. And I learned that, hey, you know, they're not going to bite you, hurt you, put it back down and let it go.
So I don't know, man.
Yeah.
A spider that's big enough that you can see it as you're driving down the road and you stop.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's a big hairy spider. I'm not sure I'd want to hold hands with
Biggest
that thing.
Biggest palm of your hand, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Were you married during any of this time?
I was married when I was with the Border Patrol.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is she aware of these stories?
Oh, absolutely, because I brought her a tarantula home one day. That didn't work too well.
Yeah. I'd say not. Holy cow.
I picked up this is later on in life. I picked up a snake in my backyard one day, a gardener snake. And he was probably 3 feet long. And I put him in a bag, and I was going to go pick my son up from school. And I thought, you know, I'm gonna scare the crap out of my son with this snake. My son got in the front seat of the car with me, and I handed him a bag. I said, here, I got something for you. My son opened the bag up, and he looked, and he said, wow, Dad, thanks, and reached in the bag and pulled a snake out. And I was like, holy cow, where did he get that from?
Oh, my gosh. I'm not scared of bugs, but snakes I'm petrified of.
Well, we, as you know, we got copperheads here in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And I actually haven't seen a rattlesnake here, but we have a lot of copperheads.
Yeah.
And you don't want to get bit by a copperhead. You're going to have trouble.
Yeah, we had in West Virginia, we had a lot of rattlesnakes, especially up in the mountains around the coal mines. They like to get in those rocks and, you know, stay warm and scare the shit out of them.
Yeah, I've never seen one down this way, but I understand they're up in the mountains in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long were you on Border Patrol?
A year and a half.
Okay. And then ATF came open? Is that
ATF, yeah, ATF came open, and I had already taken the test and passed the test. So it was just a matter of them reaching on, pulling me up.
Back then, was ATF, was that Treasury or Justice?
Yeah, back then it was Treasury.
Yeah, so
the U.S. Secret Service, ATF, the IRS, DEA at the time were all under the Treasury Department.
Yeah.
The DEA, ATF went to the Justice Department, and I believe Secret Service went to Homeland Security.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
Yeah. So that's the way that it is today.
So, and now, did you know before you hired on ATF, did you mentioned LA was your first post. Did you know you were going to go before you got hired, or you have to go through the academy and then they tell you?
No, they hire you for that position in LA. So when I was hired, I knew I was going to be in LA.
Yeah, that's just, it's just very similar to North Carolina, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
With the same demographics and everything.
Oh, yeah. And for the ATF Academy, did you have to go back to FLETC?
I sure did. Two more times. You're going to go to basic investigator school, and everybody goes to that. You'd be in class with DEA, with Secret Service, everybody else. And then you're going to go back to ATF school. You know, where you learn bomb investigations, explosives of investigations, and investigations that the Bureau of ATF get involved in.
Yeah, yeah. You That was my partner Javier went through FLETC, but by the time I came on in 87, we were already they had moved us up to go through the academy at the FBI Academy. And then several years later, DEA built its own academy up there in Quantico Marine Corps Base.
Mm-hmm.
So I never had to go through FLETC.
Well, the FBI was the only organization that didn't go through FLETC at that time. Everybody else went to FLETC. I don't even know where the FBI went.
Yeah, they had their own academy there on the Quantico Marine Corps Base. And I think this is back during the time when I forget who was in charge back then, that they were going to merge DEA into FBI. They were going to take over DEA. And so that's why they went ahead and brought us up into their academy. And thank God, you know, some people with balls stood up and against the FBI and got some congressional support. And we never did join them.
Yeah,
and that, you know, it's nothing against our DEA, our FBI brothers. I mean, we like to, the one common thing we have in law enforcement throughout the United States is we all bust on the FBI. And well, if not, you ask them, it's out of jealousy.
Not that they don't ask for it, you know.
Yeah, we still love them, though.
They're out there doing a job that hopefully they should be doing or are supposed to be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So
it's a little different today. I mean, I don't want to get into that, Steve. You know what's going on. Anyway.
Yeah, it's politics gets in the frick away of everything. You know.
Yeah, unfortunately,
You know, and I preach this on the show here all the time. As law enforcement, it's exactly that. We enforce the laws. We don't make the damn laws, and we don't adjudicate the laws after somebody's been arrested. We're just the simple fact is law enforcement is to enforce the laws.
Part of the criminal justice system. That's right.
And so when the legislators typically don't know, it's amazing how little they know when everybody else knows what's going on out there. And it from anything to when we were starting to run into counterfeit medications, and this was after I retired from DEA. I got together with a group, and we went on Capitol Hill twice. We spoke at the American Legislative Exchange Conference once, and it was just amazing that these legislators would come to you afterwards, and almost every one of them were like, I had no idea this was a problem. Well, holy cow.
Well, and that's the way that it is today, too. That's the way that it is today, too. And since you talking about DEA. I worked with he was a kid at the time, Ed Folus.
Yeah, I know Ed, yeah.
What people don't know much about Ed, I trained Ed.
Oh, yeah?
Ed, yeah, because I was in the DEA task force and in L.A. when Ed came on.
So and we can blame that on you, huh?
Yeah. He was all full of pee and vinegar. Oh, he wanted to go out there and just wrap people up. And it was like, slow down, buddy, slow down. And I took him out on an undercover operation. He loved it. And they put stuff together where he actually started getting into undercover stuff. And you know how that turned out. Well, I assume that you do. He turned out to be one of the most prolific undercover DEA agents ever.
Oh, nice.
And had written a book called The Dark Art.
Yep. And I have not read it, but I heard of it.
Yeah, where he is undercover around the world and did a bang-up job. Lucky he's still alive. But we did probably one of the most sophisticated undercover operations ever done by the United States.
Wow.
Yeah, we were trading sophisticated arms to the Shan people for heroin. And
nice.
DEA was handling overseas stuff that we had actually had to have the U.S. Navy that was going to be involved in that operation. And we had the DOD, Department of Defense, involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, ATF, DEA. It was a very, very sophisticated operation. It didn't turn out that well. Because turned out the drug people were more sophisticated than we were.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you look at the budgets we deal with and the budgets they have, they just overwhelm us on the money side, and they can change in a heartbeat.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I'll have to give Eddie a call and see if we can get him on the show here. I haven't talked to him.
You need to have him on the show. Look what he's done. He's impressive undercover background.
Good recommendation.
His history, yeah.
So You're in L.A. and you're on the task force. Is that when you started getting into undercover? Were you buying drugs and guns, or what were you doing?
No, I was already, before I had gotten involved with the DEA task force, I was already done undercover operations. Because I was in the military, and I knew military arms. In particular, mm-hmm. The M60 machine gun was one of my favorite guns when I was in Vietnam. And there were some unscrupulous people there in L.A. that was buying, let's see, it was metal materials from the military. And what they were supposed to have been doing was cutting arms up like M60 machine guns and different armaments and put them in a barrel, and they sell the barrel full of metal out to people. And they were able to smuggle M60s. M60 parts out. Somebody was selling them in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And the rumor got out there, hey, you can buy a completely functional M60 machine gun at this place. And one of the investigators there came to me and said, Billy, would you mind going in and see if you can put together a complete M60 machine gun? So I did. And went through the barrels of receivers and every stocks and everything else. And sure enough, I got all the parts for a complete M60 machine gun. Well, I bought everything, put the M60 machine gun together and said, here you are. Here's one complete M60 machine gun. And they sent me back in to buy one or two more, and then they busted the place and took it down. And it turned out to be a really good investigation. Took a lot of heavy-duty armament off the streets of Los Angeles. And because that was such a success and everybody knew Billy Queen did it, well, hell, I got another call from somebody else in some military armament situation. Will you go in here? And so I did that. And then at that point, it was just like one thing after another. So I started to dress down, let my beard grow, and started doing one undercover operation after another, and not my own investigations, but for other people.
Right.
And what
time frame are we talking about here? What years?
We're talking 83, 84, 85. Mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly what year it was that they picked me up at DEA.
Right.
To work in the task force over there. But that came, and I continued to do undercover operations. I continued to do undercover operations for the rest of my career. So I tell people for 17 of the 20 years I was there, I was doing undercover operations.
Wow. Unbelievable.
And obviously I wasn't doing undercover operations to get the Crips and the Bloods. But I could do undercover operations involving Latinos, because I spoke Spanish. And the Latino gangs will accept you into the gang as a white guy. We could get into the stories about the Mexican mafia.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of the guy's names, but one of the top Mexican mafia dudes turned out to be a white guy. And they knew that from the time that he was a kid. But he hung into the Mexican communities and with the avenues and the groups back then, and was accepted. So
it really,
as you very well know, the Mongols were a Latino motorcycle gang. So I worked undercover operations, a lot of anti-government groups, a lot of hate groups, and just a lot of gun trafficking narcotic groups out there.
So you're doing the weapons thing. What was the first anti-government group that you worked undercover on? Was it the Klan, National Alliance, Skinheads, Aryan Brotherhood?
I'm not sure which one was the first one. I think it could have been the Aryan Brotherhood. Now, there's a difference, between Aryan Nation and Aryan Brotherhood. Aryan Brotherhood is a prison gang. And how I got involved in that was there was a special organization with the California Department of Corrections out there.
Mm-hmm.
They were like special agent groups, And as you know, they listen to what's going on the phone calls all the time. And it's incredible how these people in prison are so stupid that they'll tell people outside their criminal activities or what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Well, I teamed up with those guys with the Department of Corrections. I could easily get in. Now, yeah, you had to be careful when you start dealing with prison gang people, because they want to know what prison you're in.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to be able to cover yourself when you're working undercover.
You got to have a backstop.
You got to have backstops.
So were you posing as a former inmate?
Yeah. And one of the most dangerous, my heart has pumped hard several times in undercover operations. Never any harder than working the Aryan Brotherhood. Where, you know, you're showing up to do an undercover deal, and look, you could walk in and they just blow you away. If you're going to buy drugs from people that are in the Aryan Brotherhood, I mean, they've been in prison. They're in and out of prison. It's some violent people. And today, there's no way that I would be walking through the doors that I walked through back then with the Aryan Brotherhood, because it was just freaking dangerous. You knew that they were armed. You knew they were killers. You knew they would kill you. But I did.
And what was your role in working with them? Were you trying to get them weapons?
No, I was usually buying, and it wasn't so much usually buying drugs from them. Buying guns from those people, kind of like buying guns from the Mexican Mafia. The Mexican Mafia is usually buying guns. They're usually not selling guns. And these guys that are coming out of prison, you know, they're all wanting guns. And, of course, ATF philosophy is you don't let a gun walk. Mm-hmm. You can't be selling the bad guys guns, man. They turn around and killing other cops with it or killing you with them.
Yeah.
So usually it's me that's buying. And it's usually drugs. But I walked into situations where I knew they were armed. I knew these guys were serious convicted felons and they were carrying guns. And they were in the dope business. And that's a dangerous situation. I lost friends like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And how long did you work on the Aryan Brotherhood, if you remember?
I probably worked them for a year at least. I don't know if I worked them for 2 years, but I worked them for at least a year.
Were you having to hang out with them all the time, or we just go in and do a buying and out, or how'd that work?
No, I hung with them. I hung with some of them. And, you know, some of them were... some of them you didn't have to worry about. Some of them you had to worry. I didn't go into too many situations where I had a hand on a gun. And when I'm telling you that, I had a small revolver in my pocket. I remember going into a situation where I had my hand was in my pocket and it was on the gun. I stood on one side of the room and just praying that this thing ended up as a narcotic buy and not a shootout.
Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got your handy six shot there. He might have even been a five shot back then.
Yeah, it was a five shot. I believe it was Smith & Wesson. What was the little Smith & Wesson?
I don't remember the model number, but I know what you're talking about. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like a little detective special.
I've done that numerous times throughout my career, going in with my hand on the gun.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's crazy.
Did you also have to work against the Ku Klux Klan?
I did. You know,
smile on your face when you said that.
Well, yeah, you know, because if I had been a little bit more prepared, I tried to keep little mementos, you know, because I took something from the Nazis when I worked the Nazis. I took something from it was the Christian Knights of the Ku Klux Klan was the group that I had gotten into out in North Carolina, and then when I went back to California. God, I'm trying to think of the guy's name now. Real famous Ku Klux Klan guy out there in
David,
Southern California. He was from the South, but I'll think of it in just a second.
Yeah.
Famous guy. I was with him one time, and I'm smiling because the Ku Klux Klan are just a bunch of clowns. I mean, they are clowns. They're not a threat to anybody. They want to be.
Yeah.
But they just can't.
Tom Metzger
had made a lot of noise out in California. He actually ran for an office out there, a political office, and won the primary.
Ooh.
And I was with the Christian Knights of the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina. And when I went out to California, Tom Metzger had just won the primary. And I thought, God, the Ku Klux Klan must be big time out here in California. So I searched and I got a way in to the Klan out there through a Jewish guy that had to work off a beef for some crap that he had done, but he's a Jewish guy. Ku Klux. I mean, these guys hate the Jews.
Yeah.
But he's in with Metzger. And so he's going to take me in to Metzger's group, which I think it was down in Long Beach at that time or somewhere south of LA.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, this is going to really turn into a big deal. And when I got there, there was like six of us, and two of us were undercover. So there's like four guys there at this big Tom Metzger meeting, and I'm standing around with him for about 30 minutes, and nobody else is showing up. And I ask Metzger, "Hey, where is everybody? And when they getting here?" Metzger looked at me and said, "This is it.
Oh,
there's six of us here, and two of them are undercover."
Look at the time. I got to go.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I did. I went back to the office and just closed that investigation down.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
who was the other undercover? Was he ATF or was he another agency?
No. This Jewish guy.
This
Jewish informant is what he was.
Yeah. Did Metzger realize he was Jewish?
No, he didn't know.
Idiot.
No, they were both scam artists.
Idiot. Hey, players, this is the end of part one. As you know, part two comes out tomorrow on a Tuesday. In the meantime, on social media, go and check us out on X at Game of Crimes and on Facebook and Instagram at Game of Crimes Podcast. Also on Facebook, type in Game of Crimes fan page and join us for some more fun. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including all our episodes, the book list, which contains the books written by our guests, Game of Crimes merchandise, and a lot more. In the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.